Aloha. Welcome to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. As we close out October, we talk about preservation in a nod to Preservation Month. Today is actually the 20th anniversary of the day the destructive floodwaters barreled through the University of Hawaii Manoa campus. We've been talking about it all week. It destroyed and damaged historic documents and taught us hard lessons about resilience, restoration, and loss. We ask, how vulnerable are our other treasures? We talk about geothermal power. After years of resistance, what's possible for this natural resource? Some see dollar signs. We tip our hats to the longest-serving city worker. He was hired in the 60s at the Department of Motor Vehicles. Here is to customer service and public service. Mahalo, Howard Okamura. And volleyball victory. A small Big Island school's team breaks through to the state tournament after 49 years. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today marks 20 years since raging floodwaters did millions of dollars in damage to the University of Hawaii at Manoa campus. Hardest hit was Hamilton Library. Its map collection and rare books, including Prince Kuhio's personal collection, were damaged or destroyed in the water and mud that collected in the basement. Back in 2010, library staff was still sifting through damaged materials from the flood. Here's Lynn Davis, head of the UH Preservation Department.
We're really dismayed and astonished that evening of October 30th when I came here and saw the mud, the acres of mud around the library, and the damage that the flood caused by the surge of the water against the map cases. It was, I think it was 8 feet, the water mark, and the power of the water was just like a tsunami. It surged back and forth and it forced mud into the map cases. The important thing was to freeze them as quickly as possible to prevent mold growth. We moved out at least 50,000 maps and put them into 5 Matson containers. And after they were stabilized, we were then able to start discussing what needed to be done for treatment.
Today, we hear from the Hawaii State Archivist about what's being done to protect our valuable and historic government documents and artifacts in the historic Capitol District. The downtown offices are just across the street from the Kalani Moku building, where key government computers are housed in the basement and are prone to flooding. There are government documents at the State Archives, treasured artifacts at Iolani Palace, and books and periodicals at the State Main library branch that should be protected. Archivist Adam Jansen talked with us about efforts to safeguard our historic treasures.
The difficulty with water in particular is not the initial damage from the water itself. It's if you don't have a rapid response to it, that water very quickly turns into mold. And once mold sets in on those types of paper materials, it is incredibly difficult to get rid of. And you can't expose your researchers to toxic mold spores in order to view these things. And as a result, if there isn't a plan in place and if you can't respond quickly enough, your materials are going to be lost.
I do recall talking to the university librarians and they said, yeah, we had Prince Kuhio's book collection and they were, you know, working desperately to save those books and the maps were downstairs.
And there's the difficulty is when you have that volume of materials, where do you get enough freezer trucks to be able to bring in so that you can at least stabilize those materials until you can address them? And I think the way you articulated it is the vulnerabilities is really the way that we as memory institutions need to reevaluate our programs is what are our vulnerabilities and do we have those plans in place that when the worst happens, we can respond to it cohesively as a team and be able to address these issues.
I don't believe you're in the flood zone and you're there with the Hawaii State Library, the Iolani Palace. You know, I know the palace has plans for, I think it's like a $3 million renovation of the basement galleries. The library used to have all the microfiche that we would go down to look at for the old newspapers. You know, I understand that the patrons are no longer allowed down in the basement, but what are your plans for in the event of a flood?
We've been very fortunate in that we are just outside the flood zone, but with global warming and sea level rise, we don't know when and if those maps are going to be updated. But that being said, you know, knock on wood, we have been in this area on palace ground since 1905, and we've never had a flood in our basement. And really, just because we have subterranean space doesn't necessarily create a larger exposure profile for us, because buildings can be constructed so that they can handle being in a flood table. The greatest example of that for our archives is probably the Maryland Archives, which is just next door to the ocean. And they knew this, so they built that facility to be watertight up to and including the doors that they use on those facilities. So knowing this, part of what we need to do is take into account what are these vulnerabilities and what is the importance of the materials being stored in these facilities, so that when we build, when we retrofit, we take these considerations into mind so that we help protect against worst case scenarios. So for us, you know, we try not to store anything of permanent value in the basement. Mostly what that is downstairs are publications, government publications, maps, things that, you know, if worst comes to worst, we could purchase a new book or a new map, because they made hundreds, if not thousands or tens of thousands of these. And so for us, it's trying to keep everything, you know, upstairs, which is 15 feet above ground level. And ideally, if we have a flood that's over 15 feet tall, we've got much larger problems to have to consider.
I know that, you know, there are discussions about building a new state archives, because we're probably running out of space, and we are going to be saving a lot of important government documents for the future. I'm sure there are best practices, and you know, with the technological advances, you are working to try and digitize a lot of our treasures as well.
And that's absolutely correct. And we are right now halfway into the development of a master plan for the future of the archives, because as you alluded to, we are actually over capacity. We have no more shelf space. We're actually putting boxes on top of shelves because we refuse to stop preserving history. If we don't grab it now, the chances of it still being here in 5 or 10 years, when and if we have additional storage capacity, is not a chance I'm willing to take. So with that being said, as we move forward, we will utilize the latest in engineering design to be able to make this facility watertight. We know it can be done. You know, there's plenty of examples of highways and train tunnels going underneath rivers, and in fact, you know, with the tunnel going underneath the ocean and being able to stay watertight. So it can be done if it's done and approached with that mentality at the initial design. And to help protect against those worst case scenarios, we are focusing on digitizing the most important records in our holdings, those that protect your rights, your identity, your property, your history, so that not only can we increase accessibility to those who cannot travel due to financial or physical means, but then also to do it at such a level of quality that we have a digital surrogate should the worst ever happen. We have that digital copy that is at least as good of quality as the original.
And, you know, we've been talking to the state comptroller, who says that, you know, a lot of the vital information for government services, you know, is being migrated to the cloud. So do we have any system right now for backing up our computers over there at the archives?
Yeah, we do routinely back up the materials. We're old school. We don't trust the cloud. We like backup tapes, because that gives us an offline copy that protects us against, you know, cyber attacks of any kind, because there are some large profile, well-known instances where cloud systems have crashed. And as a result, those businesses that trusted that system lost vast amounts of data. So just putting it up in the cloud is not necessarily a cure-all, because as I tell my students, you know, the cloud is just somebody else's computer. It's not really any different than what we do here. but it does give you that geographic remoteness so that if there is an instance of some type of localized event, it's highly unlikely that it is also going to affect anything that you've stored in the cloud. And these cloud systems also have very robust internal data checks so that it's much less likely you'll have a hard drive fail and wipe things out, or that there'll be bit rot as you store those materials over the long term. So there are definitely distinct advantages to the cloud, but I don't see it necessarily as a cure-all over the long term for the most important records that have to be kept forever.
Well, I was just downtown by your facility this weekend, and I did note that the State Library, it looks like it's having some roof repair work done, and I know the Palace has been dealing with leaks as well, but I don't know. What's your situation with your roof?
We were very fortunate that DAGS, the Department of Accounting and General Services, and the Central Services Division replaced our roof, because we were 20 years into supposedly a 30-year roof, but this is Hawaii. Very, very intense sun, UV damage. So we were having a few problems with some leaks as well. And so we were able to very positively address that and have a roof now with a 20-year warranty.
Well, you know, this is high season, high holiday for scary stuff. And I don't know what keeps you up at night, whether it's fire or rain, because if there is, let's say, a fire, you know, I don't know what kind of fire protection system you have.
Of all the scenarios, fire to us is one of the least concerning, because we do have a Halon gas fire suppression system. And there isn't anything that puts a fire out faster that you can obtain than Halon. But unfortunately, it's also a known ozone depletant and hasn't been made since 1990s. And so as a result, it's incredibly difficult to obtain. But the legislature did approve an upgrade for us. So we are in the process of upgrading our fire suppression to a more modern gas, something we can fill locally on here on island. So of all the possible scenarios, that is less of a concern to us than water intrusion, pests. Termites and silverfish are all over the island. And so trying to make sure that we keep a lid on that is really one of our biggest concerns. And we've been highly successful with that. So we need to maintain our diligence. But for us, you know, the biggest factor is always the human factor. That's the one thing that is incredibly difficult to plan for. So we're always trying to be very diligent about those types of intrusion vectors.
So what scares you the most? What keeps you up at night?
What keeps me up at night? Honestly, it's more of a funding issue. Do we have sustained funding? What happens during the next economic downturn? Because archives in general, memory institutions across the island are not highly prized by those in power necessarily. And so they see, well, you know, okay, we're going to cut your staff in half. But we're already understaffed as it is to serve the public needs. So to me, that is the biggest risk, is not understanding the societal value of what we do over the long term and making sure that it's adequately funded. Because most people don't realize how important archives are until you need that one record that we have to help protect your rights.
So you don't know what you got till it's gone.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Adam. I certainly appreciate your time today, in this nod for Preservation Month.
It's always a pleasure speaking with you, Catherine.
That was Hawaii State Archivist Adam Jansen talking to us about safeguarding our historic documents and artifacts in the downtown Capital District. Today, we mark 20 years since a destructive flood caused millions in damage to the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Rare historic documents, including Prince Koheo's book collection, were among the treasures lost or damaged.
In Morocco, climate change is making the drought worse, so the country needs new ways to maintain its water supply. One solution? Tap into seawater.
Now we are in this site of desalination station because we think that in Morocco, this is the solution.
What it takes to climate-proof Morocco's waterways, that's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1. Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, Bavarian Motor Experts, and Chaminade University.
Geothermal rising, that was the theme of an energy conference this past weekend held at the Hilton Waikoloa Village on the Big Island. HPR reporter Savannah Harriman-Pote was there covering the gathering, and she joins us now to talk about the emerging issues. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what was different about this conference?
Yeah, so Geothermal Rising is an international organization that is meant to bring together professionals who work in geothermal across the world. And they hosted a big industry conference this week in Waikoloa on Hawaii Island. But something that they did for the very first time before we really got into the industry part of the conference was they brought together leaders and community members from different indigenous communities across the Pacific in places as far away as Taiwan and British Columbia and New Zealand and, of course, Hawaii to talk about the successes and concerns that members of indigenous communities have had with geothermal. And this was the first time that they had done that. They hope to do more. And there were a lot of really interesting conversations that were had at that forum.
It can advance us. We don't have to go to state legislature every year asking for money like every other state department does. We can start a internal revenue stream. That's constant for generations, you know. And then again, the end game is to advance our people towards self-sufficiency, self-determination, and you will achieve financial sovereignty, for lack of better words, or financial independence. You know, we're not relying on anybody else. You know, that'll be huge for people.
So that's Makai Freitas, and he's the Department of Hawaiian Homelands Commissioner for West Hawaii. And the reason why Makai and other members of the Department of Hawaiian Homelands were in participation at this forum is because scientists think that there may be far more geothermal resources than Hawaii currently has tapped, and a lot of those could be found under Hawaiian homestead lands. So as you heard in that clip, if DHHL was able to tap into some of those resources, that could be a huge economic opportunity for them. But Freitas was very clear that he would only be interested in pursuing geothermal energy if that revenue could translate into benefits for Native Hawaiian beneficiaries.
The benefit starts with our Native Hawaiian community beneficiaries. That is a core focus of this. If there is a resource that is found and it is, you know, culturally, environmentally, and economically pono, it starts with our beneficiaries. That, I think sometimes people get lost in how this potential resource can help everybody else, which it can. It can help a lot of other people. But it starts at home. It starts with our people. It starts with their advancement. It starts with bettering their lives. It starts with, again, you know, helping them not just build homes, but the spectrum of needs, healthcare, early education, building capacity to help them run their own businesses, just helping their overall life in Hawaii so they can stay here and raise their families here. That's a core focus. That's where it starts.
Well, I know there was lots of pushback, you know, early on when folks were trying to get geothermal really going here in Hawaii. But yeah, folks are looking at it differently.
Yeah, and Freitas acknowledged that pushback. He said it is something that absolutely needs to be considered as DHHL initiates these conversations. Some folks see geothermal as a desecration of sacred lands. They think it's a violation of lands that of their relationship to Pele, and he does not want to dismiss that. But he says that he feels like the conversation might be in a different place now than it was 10 years ago as people are considering climate change and they're considering the cost of living, and they also have examples from other communities that have had success with geothermal. So, for instance, some of the folks who were in attendance at the forum were from New Zealand. I spoke to Luke Tamati Cassidy. He's the operations manager for a geothermal plant that has been owned outright by an iwi, a Maori tribe, since 2005. And a trust controls the geothermal project and a few of the tribe's other ventures. And Cassidy, who both works for the plant and is a beneficiary of the trust, says they have been able to channel revenue from geothermal into all sorts of programs.
It's been challenging, but we are now getting some tangible events. December this year, we would have built two brand new homes, and that will give the beneficiaries option, and we're still networking and workshopping with them. Do they want to rent to buy? Do they want, do they want us to sell it to the market? But the beneficiaries decide. So that's the first thing. And then we've got a two-year plan to have another 30 more houses. So housing is one. We bought a 25% share in a medical centre for GP visits for our people. They are the lowest in terms of cost to visit the GP is $20 for an adult. So that's significantly quite cheap in New Zealand. And the reason why we bought it is because we wanted our beneficiaries to go there. We can control that cost, and it's just better health outcomes for our people.
Yeah, so, we, like I said, did hear a lot about Native Hawaiians pushing back, messing with Pele and geothermal. But I think after looking at New Zealand, they're saying, hey, we might be able to harness this and help our people.
Yeah, and it's not just New Zealand. There are organizations and members of indigenous communities in Taiwan, for instance, that are looking into this. They have not developed geothermal extensively, but 70% of the geothermal resources are on land that belongs to indigenous communities. In British Columbia, they are developing a geothermal plant, which would be the first in that entire province, and that is also completely controlled and owned by indigenous peoples, the Fort Nelson's First Nation. So there are a lot of examples that people have to bring into this conversation that they didn't have 10 or 15 years ago. But it is still likely going to be a tough sell. Previous geothermal attempts have left deep wounds in the community. And if you attend a community meeting for Puno Geothermal Venture, which is our only geothermal plant in Hawaii, some members of the Puna community especially are very vocal about environmental and cultural concerns that they have about geothermal. And Freda says that the early outreach that they're doing to Native Hawaiian beneficiaries about just the possibility of developing geothermal resources on their land has gotten mixed results. So he says we're still very much in an information gathering phase, but he's hoping that people approach this topic with an open mind. And he wants to make sure that he's clear that he will only support projects that have demonstrable benefits for Native Hawaiians.
If this does come to fruition, okay, what benefits are Native Hawaiians gonna see? Is it life changing benefits, or is it just here's just a break on your electric bill? For me, it's got to be a life changing advancement. This is a big deal, and if it's not something that's gonna really move our people, it really drastically, move our people and our beneficiaries towards self-sufficiency and self-determination and really truly give us the final financial independence, it's a no-go.
Yeah, interesting to see, how this will play out. Anything else that you want to talk about with this conference?
Well, part of this is just the science, right? So, for instance, there are representatives from the university there who are doing research on geothermal, and they say, it's possible that there's enough geothermal energy, not just on Hawaii Island, but across the islands to power the whole state. We don't know because we haven't looked. And so there are efforts to get more funding from the state legislature to give us a better map of what our resources are. Geothermal is discovered through very, very small holes drilled very deeply into the earth. And those clarify what resources we might have on geothermal, but also what resources we might have in terms of fresh water. So if there's aquifers that we're not yet aware of, that could be another thing that we discover if we invest more into researching our underground resources.
Right, yeah. And then lots of talk about hydrogen as well. But thanks so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote. She covers energy and climate issues for us. Look for her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, oahu, umolokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhavai.
We've been rummaging through the trunks for Halloween inspiration. The author and personality who came to mind will always be associated with ghosts and the supernatural in Hawaii. Born in California, Glenn Grant moved to the islands in 1970, where he found a rich intersection of cultural traditions. Friends say that he enjoyed spinning a good yarn and was a riveting storyteller. He collected stories about psychic phenomenon and the supernatural, which he shared in books like the Obaki Files, as well as the Chicken Skin ghost story anthologies. His popularity grew, and he hosted the Chicken Skin radio show and occasionally reported for NPR about Hawaiian legends. But did you know that Grant's dad was a Hollywood special effects wizard? His movie credits included The Wizard of Oz and science fiction film Forbidden Planet. In fact, the famous 7-foot-tall robot created for Forbidden Planet ended up living in Grant's garage. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this famous on-screen robot? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets a reusable HPR tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nāreit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services. NāreitHawaii.com.
Years ago this month, the hit songs on the radio included We'll Sing in the Sunshine, Pretty Woman, and Doo Wah Diddy Diddy.
There she was, just walking down the street singing.
You know, back then, a young Howard Okamura, not too long after graduating from Farrington High School, applied for a job as a clerk typist at the Honolulu DMV, the Division of Motor Vehicles. The pay was less than $3 an hour, which he thought was a lot of money at the time. He got the job and is still there. Back then, the Honolulu mayor was Neil Blaisdell, and this month, Mayor Rick Blangiardi honored Okamura to officially thank him for his public service. His office threw a surprise party on his anniversary date, and to throw him off, they told him it was a co-worker's birthday and assigned him his specialty potluck dish, potato mac salad, but made with spaghetti. We sat down with Okamura yesterday afternoon at the Kapalama DMV offices. Okamura turned 80 this year and chuckles that even he can't believe he stayed as long as he did.
And I was thinking, you know, maybe 35 years. But when 35 years came around, no, I didn't go. 40 years came around, I still was there. 50 years came around, I still there. And look what happened now. It's 60 years. Time flies. When I first started, it was mostly we type our own document and punch card at the same time, which was, you know, IBM cards. Now it's all computerization. So that's a big change right there already. And now they're trying to put it online so that way you don't have files and all that. The only part is that kind of stuff. If the power goes down, how are you going to get to the files?
And so you were down at the DMV, oh gosh, when it was?
When it was at the old police station on Bertani Street.
Paua. Right.
Paua.
The old Sears.
Yeah, the old Sears building. And that time, it wasn't, the registration wasn't staggered. It was January to December. then there was a grace period from January to March to renew it. If not, after that, it's penalty. And March 31st, we had the last 25,000, mind you, 25,000 didn't register their car yet. And the line on that day, oh, we had lines all zigzagging in the parking lot, and we had to straighten out the line. One line was on Young Street, and the other line went on Britannia, and the two line met at Keomoku. Can you imagine how many people that is? And we had to have people going through the line and checking the line and cut the line when maybe about 3:30, so that, you know, we can close it at least by decent time, which we close at 4:30, but then most time we had to close maybe about 5 something.
Not a very efficient way to do business.
And we had to balance that night and be ready to man the counter the next morning. And one time, March 31st was on a Sunday, and the head of our office told our office, can you come Sunday? So we were thinking about it, and we told them, okay, we come in. And then we came in. We lucky we had 100 on that day. When came Monday, the line was just like any March 31st, was horrendous.
Well, I'm sure this work is, like you say, it's endless, right? It's tedious, mm-hmm. but it's got to be done. It's the kind of thing, if you're a upstanding citizen, you do the right thing and you register your car, you know, when it expires.
To me, they shouldn't have made staggered. They should have maybe moved the expiration to another month, because December 31st and then January to March, that's tax time. So people don't have money to do registration. You tell them, oh, pinch next time, you know, and all that. They should have just moved the deadline and maybe increased the penalty. To have the same manpower 30 years ago, and you know, motor vehicle registration and increase from 30 years ago to now, overtime, they gotta appropriate more money for overtime.
Yeah, because if you aren't increasing your staff and your workload is whatever, quadrupled, you know?
And then now they're only holding 20,000. 20,000 will not take care of the backlog and all that. We had backlog, mind you, these past 2 weeks, we had backlog of maybe 10 trays. The trays were about 3 feet long. 10 of them, they didn't have money for pay overtime. You know, something is wrong there, you know.
We've been hearing from Howard Okamura, the city's longest-serving worker. His coworkers affectionately call him Uncle. Okamura says his coworkers keep him young, and among his favorite memories are the Pauhana gatherings. He does speak his mind about things that don't sit right with him, though. He did speak highly of a DMV long-serving boss, Dennis Kamimura, who he says used to take the Hawaii Revised Statutes home with him to study. Okamura says Kamimura knew his stuff and was always receptive to new ideas and how to do things better.
His mind was always open. Dennis' mind was always open to new suggestion and whatever. The registration, when we saw some states, they had it barcoded. So when I told him, oh, we should do that barcoding. And when he said barcoding, I said, yeah. Some of the states, they had it barcoded on the document. He said, oh, that's a good idea. So he was open for how to do work.
What is it that you love about this job? I mean, you stuck around for a long time. A lot of people would have, you know, moved around, maybe go to work for the state, go to work for private sector. What is it about public service that made you stay?
Well, as far as the work at our office, I know it backwards and forward already by now. It doesn't bother me, you know. I just do whatever they tell me, and they don't have to tell me how to do it because I know how to do it already. Yeah, I just buy the time away and just do my work, whatever is assigned.
And then what was it like during COVID? Because the work still had to get done.
Yeah. Well, they had to space our desks and then put the walls in between the desks. They could hardly do anything because they move us in this building here. When we were at the other side on Gateway, it was a bigger building. When they move us here, we had to rent offices next door, which you're paying outside now. Before, everything was with the city.
So as far as the work that you do, so you deal with customers on the phone, you process the registrations, you know, behind the scenes, on the back of the house, right? You've done both.
So a lot of time, you gotta get the information from the individual, just like pulling a teeth. You gotta get it from them before you can tell them exactly what is required.
Anything you don't like to do at this job?
The mail, because it's a lot of rejects, a lot of the document that they mail in. They mail it in any old way, you know, and then you gotta kind of piece it out, and a lot of other state company like that, they assume that they know, but then they don't know. So we gotta kind of educate them. And if they don't give us phone numbers, we got no choice but to send it back to them and tell them this and that and whatever. And if they have any question, to call us up and we give them the phone number. Before, when we moved into this building, it was strictly for handicapped. They open it up for regular people. So now when the handicapped wanna use, they say it's all full. That's not right, you know, because the federal law says you gotta provide for the handicap.
So you think we can do better?
Yes.
Anything else you wanna share with us?
No, I guess it's just dealing with the public. You know, it's very challenging. It's not the same every day. Some days it's different from the other days, you know.
You think people are more rude these days?
Depend on how you take it, huh? They grumble to you and whatever. So I put them in place. I tell them, why are you taking it out on me? What did I do to you? You know, then they kind of calm down and whatever.
They just need a vent. But yeah, sometimes they can be inconsiderate and not so nice to city workers.
They say, oh, things weren't coming their way. I said, that happens to everybody, not only you. You know.
So yeah, if you're having a terrible, no good, very bad day, just don't take it out on the city employees.
Yeah, so whether city employees or anybody, you gotta change your attitude. It's not me. You take care of other person, they take care of you.
Ah, wise words of wisdom. Ogumura also spoke highly of the city's longest-serving mayor. He felt Mayor Frank Fossey really cared for the little guy and had big visions for Oahu. He laments that Fossey never got to be governor. Ogumura was hired under Mayor Neil Blaisdell in October of 1964. He says he has no real plans to retire. His supervisor is in her 80s, too. Ogumura still drives his trusty Toyota Corolla to work every day and doesn't plan on getting on rail. And his one pet peeve is that employees in the department who register vehicles for the general public have to stand in line like everyone else to get their paperwork done. No special treatment.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
False claims about the 2024 election are expected to get worse after Election Day.
To claim that they could not have seen it coming if there is post-election violence is absolutely irresponsible. We can all see it coming.
How social media companies are preparing for a deluge of misinformation after votes are cast. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art. On view now, Home of the Tigers, McKinley High, and Modern Art includes work by Satoru Abe, Imai Kalani Kalahele, Ralph Iwamoto, and more. HonoluluMuseum.org.
For today's Mono Minute, we hear the calls of seabirds whose long red tail feathers are prized for featherworking. Thanks to Zeno Kanto for these recordings. Here's a University of Hawaii at Hilo professor, Patrick Hart.
Hawaii ula, or red-tailed tropic birds, are one of the most striking seabirds we might see around the Hawaiian Islands. Bright white with wingspans close to 4 feet, they have two long, streaming, bright red tail feathers that set them apart from all other birds. In earlier times, these feathers were highly valued by feather workers and were used in the making of kahili that often surrounded royalty. Kauai ula are well-built for soaring above the ocean and are known to make spectacular dives from over 150 feet to catch fish and squid from near the ocean's surface. They rarely fish within sight of land and are known to follow boats to catch the flying fish that scatter as they move through the sea. Their calls have been described as a loud, sharp bark, sometimes with a piercing scream that's mostly heard around their breeding grounds. These tropic birds are found only across tropical latitudes of the Indian and Pacific Oceans. In Hawaii, they breed across all of the Northwest Hawaiian Islands, as well as a few places on the main islands. After performing an impressive aerial courtship display that includes a series of backward somersaults, they lay just one egg, which is incubated and cared for by both parents. Unlike their white-tailed cousins that mainly nest on steep cliffs, Kauai ula usually nest on flat ground in the shade of low shrubs. This makes them very susceptible to mammalian predators like dogs and cats, which is why they rarely nest on any of the main Hawaiian islands. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society, connecting the community with the Manu O Ku through programs to promote awareness, appreciation, and conservation of the official bird of Honolulu. Learn more at hiaudubon.org.
And now it's time for the answer to the backyard quiz. Author Glenn Grant is synonymous with ghosts and Halloween. As a folklorist, spooky kind tales were a way of life for him. He was a very prolific writer and published the Obake Files and Chicken Skin series of books. He taught for the University of Hawaii and was popular for his lively lectures. He'd share the same enthusiasm when telling ghost stories or conducting Honolulu ghost tours, and I have been on many of those, and they were fabulous. The popularity of his spooky portfolio garnered him a radio show aptly titled Chicken Skin. He also ran a cafe called The Haunt, and his love for the supernatural may have been steeped in his childhood. His dad, Cliff Grant, was a special effects wizard who worked on films like The Day the Earth Stood Still and The Forbidden Planet. The younger Grant recalled seeing the iconic 7-foot robot from The Forbidden Planet stashed in the family garage on a daily basis, so much that he affectionately called Robbie the Robot his brother. And congrats to our winner today. John Ikeda from Honolulu says that film was one of his favorite sci-fi movies. And that's our quiz for today. You have one to share, write to Talk Back at hawaiipublicradio.org. The state championships for girls high school volleyball began this week. Among the Division II schools that are competing is Parker School. It's a small private school on the Big Island, and this is the first time its girls team qualified for the state tournament in the school's nearly 50-year history. The conversation's Russell Subiono got the chance to sit down with the team's coach, Sharon Peterson, earlier this week.
That's the sound of the Parker School girls volleyball team after the win earlier this month that qualified them for the state championship tournament. In the school's 49-year history, only one other team sport has qualified for the state tournament, boys soccer, back in the late 1990s. The school has more speech and debate accolades than sports titles. Naturally, I was curious as to what changed this year. So I reached out to the team's coach, Sharon Peterson, whose resume is stacked. 5-time All-American, member of the first two U.S. Women's Olympic teams, coached the University of Hawaii at Hilo to 7 national championships, 5-time Coach of the Year, member of several Halls of Fame, including the Hawaii Sports Hall of Fame. She also coached the Hawaii Preparatory Academy girls and boys volleyball teams to multiple BIIF, Big Island Interscholastic Federation championships, and 24 combined state tournament berths. Under Coach Peterson's guidance, Parker's girls volleyball team finished 17-3 this year. Can you describe the vibe amongst the girls right now?
Well, to say the least, they're excited. This is something new for them, but I do have to keep reminding them it is a business trip. We're here to do the best that we can, even though they're going to Honolulu, might like to go to the mall, etc. But I think they're really ready to be at their best. They've worked hard. They've been together this season, and even during the summer, we had optional practices. And at first I said, well, maybe we can do it 3 times a week. And they say, no, every day. So that tells you the type of commitment that they have made to this season.
When we look at recent BIIF Division II champs and state tournament participants for girls volleyball, we see Kona Waena and Hawaii Prep quite a bit. Two schools that have the ability to draw from large pools of talent in different ways. Parker is a small school that draws students from different parts of the islands and isn't well known or best known for its athletics. What do you believe is the reason this year's team has been able to achieve so much?
Well, I think we have a great combination of players. We have 5 freshmen that have played club and are talented. We have 4 juniors and 1 sophomore, kind of the middle of the group, and then 5 seniors. So it's a good mix. And I think that they work well together. They bring to the table different experiences and different talents.
And when we look at the state of youth sports today, you mentioned some of your players have played club. There seems to be a lot more opportunities for athletes to hone their skills before they get to high school, which wasn't necessarily the case back in my day or back in the early days of the school. How much has that impacted the team and maybe sports in general there on the Big Island?
Well, I think it's huge, and especially in Honolulu, club is just really kind of at the top because kids play club so that they can possibly gain a scholarship. And sometimes high school volleyball is kind of second best, but I think that we gain a lot from just having their experiences and giving them some new things to learn. I would say even with the club players at any stage, they have good habits and they have some bad habits. And the best we can do as coaches at club or at high school level is to try to get them to have more good habits so they have an easier time on the court.
When this season started for your girls, was there a feeling amongst the team that it would be a special season or that they had what it took to go to the BIIF championship game or make the state tournament?
Well, I can tell you my opinion was I had no expectations. The first year, I don't remember how we finished. I've been here 3 years, but I think it was below 500. The second year, we're 8-6. And so going into this year, we had kind of a new squad here with a lot of new people. I didn't have any expectations, but we worked hard. And the one thing that we really wanted to focus on was spirit. You know, we figured we might not be the tallest team or the quickest team, but we could be the most spirited team. And I think that really propelled us through the season and hoping that it continues at the state tournament.
I know you coached the volleyball teams at Hawaii Prep for 17 years and brought the best out of those teams. After you left the school, what did you see in the Parker girls volleyball team that led you to want to coach there?
Well, I love coaching. So, I mean, I've been doing that for over 50 years. And I fell in love with it at Punahou. I was a PE teacher, and there you had to also coach sports. And once I started coaching a sport, I just said, this is for me. So that's my background. But seeing the Parker School, for me, not so much of exactly their talent, but that they were interested in volleyball. They had an interest. They had a love for volleyball. And what I wanted to do was to bring out their best. So for every year, it has been like that. And it has built. The first year, I'm sure they had a hard time adjusting to my discipline, you might say, or my really focus on the skills, but not only the skills, but how to work as a team. And that's a lot of learning. But if you don't learn, you can't improve. So we really focused on that. And I think that this year we've got a good group and we have been learning for the past 3 years. So I feel excited as I did at the beginning. I really didn't care how good they were, but that they were there for volleyball and I was there for volleyball. So we had a good fit.
And when you first took over the team, you touched on it a little bit just now. Did you instill anything specific into the players or make any specific changes to the program that you can trace back now as to the foundation for this year's success?
Probably the one thing that I stress is that we wanted to be competitive and that it wasn't going to be like a PE class. We were going to compete at the best level that we were capable of. And I think that's how I feel. So every day I prepare. It takes maybe an hour or 2 hours just to prepare a practice to try to get a nice progression of learning. And so that they really come away with a feeling of being mentally tougher, emotionally tougher, and having a great team play.
You've been in the sport for a long time. You've seen incredible success and earned many accolades over your career as both player and coach. You've seen how volleyball and sports in general can benefit young women. How do you hope this season will influence and impact your players in their lives?
Well, if they want to go on in volleyball, that would be one impact on their lives. But if they don't, I have heard from quite a few of my former players about how the volleyball season helped them just to be mentally tougher in their life, to be able to make better decisions, and to be able to maintain a spirit and good thoughts and good feelings. And that is the basis for a successful life.
Coach Peterson, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Well, that was Parker School's girls volleyball coach, Sharon Peterson, talking with HPR's Russell Subiano. Peterson's team will be taking on number 4 ranked Castle High School in the first round of the Division II state championship tournament tonight. In full disclosure, Parker School is an underwriter of HPR. Okay, we have to go now. We're out of time, but up tomorrow, it's Halloween, so we're keeping it spooky by talking to the author of a new novel titled The Night Marchers. Leave us your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.